This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and let's check in to get another take on how the 2018 midterm elections went here in Indiana and elsewhere with Andy Downs. He's Executive Director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at Purdue University, Fort Wayne. Andy, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, first, let's get the shorthand version of what you think about how the election turned out.
The shortest version I can give is that for the most part, it went pretty well throughout the state, but there were some places with problems. That, of course, is actually not that unusual, but the problems were a little larger than usual.
I know that we've talked, of course, a lot here in Northwest Indiana about the problems in Porter County. Porter County was not the only county that had delayed returns. I understand in talking with some of my colleagues that Henry County in Newcastle, south of Muncie, had problems. They'd just gotten some new software, though, and new equipment. So I think it was a case where they maybe hadn't gotten completely acclimated to how the equipment worked or getting all the bugs worked out, so to speak, as can happen with software. So that's the reason that they had delays with their election returns over in Henry County. But Porter County's was a much, much bigger problem.
Certainly much bigger problem. And we should point out that when new systems are being used, there is a learning curve. A lot of counties would prefer to use new systems, whether those are poll pads, electronic poll books, or new machines, et cetera, in a year in which we don't anticipate a lot of turnout. Midterm elections are a good time to do that because traditionally they have lower turnout than presidential. Even municipal election years, or some counties would say it's even better to try it out then because that's when we have the smallest amount of turnout. That does not make the races any less important. It's just, you know, in terms of working out the kinks, you have an easier time of it. But part of the problem we just experienced was almost presidential year election results, or turnout, I should say, causing really big problems. There were a lot of voters who showed up, and on the one hand, that's great. But if you were trying out a new system, that was going to complicate things.
Now, we talked here about Porter County, and I mentioned here about Henry County, the problems there. Were there any other counties that you were aware of through election day and election night that had some problems, or was it kind of centered down to these two counties in particular?
Well, those are the worst. There were some issues in a couple of southern counties where they were, you know, things like running out of voter registration forms. In fact, even in the county, in Allen County where I am, they ran out of change in address forms and some precincts and those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. But the issues that were experienced elsewhere were sort of the normal run-of-the-mill things that we encounter. Porter County is, of course, getting the most attention.
What do you think that obviously will have to be done, since you're familiar with all of these systems and the problems that counties run into and in getting ready for elections? What do you think might have to be done here to be ready for the municipal elections, which will be the next ones coming up here next year?
Truth be told, a number of the counties, granted it was not pleasant this time around, but they know where the weak spots are. If they were at all introspective throughout the day, they were figuring them out, and certainly after the fact, they'll be able to look at themselves and say, okay, this is where the big problems were. We know how to address them next time. And, of course, one of the things that has to happen, I think, on a regular basis is, you know, we guess what the turnout's going to be, and then typically we should add to it. You know, we think, okay, turnout's going to be 35%. Oops, this is an exciting year. Maybe we ought to bump that up to 50%. Or we think it's going to be 19%. We should bump that up to 25, 26%. That way the increased turnout doesn't end up causing as much difficulty as it does. And then, unfortunately, voters, they may not be happy about it, but voters have to sort of accept that when we have really high turnout, you know, 55, 60% turnout, that just means we're going to have to wait in line. And I know that's not pleasant for a lot of people, but if you think back to 2008, for example, most of the counties had all of their election equipment out and being used, and there were still very long lines that people had to wait in because we had such good turnout. But most folks who are buying this equipment, county councils, et cetera, aren't going to be interested in buying enough equipment to have, you know, 70% turnout, because most of that equipment will just sit in a warehouse someplace, not getting used.
Right. Now let's talk here in particular about the races. You had an opportunity as well, too, to being a participant in the election night coverage that we carried here on Lakeshore Public Radio, and that was through the Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations out of Indianapolis. But you there in Fort Wayne had a chance to chime in. What do you think the results as far as the U.S. Senate race are lessons we need to have learned from that?
I think there are several things to look at. One of the things is that the Democrats may want to be reconsidering what they consider to be the best model for a successful candidate. You know, for quite some time, if you wanted to be a successful statewide candidate as a Democrat, you looked like Evan Bayh. You were a moderate. You campaigned in a certain way. But we have seen in 2016 with his loss, and then in 2018 with Joe Donnelly's loss, that maybe that's not the model that works any longer. And I'm just going to mention two counties that helped to make that point. Well, actually, five counties. First, I want to mention Lake, Marion, and Monroe counties, which, as we all know, are Democratic strongholds. In 2008, they made up approximately 25% of all the votes cast in the state of Indiana. This year, it's going to be something closer to 21, maybe 22%. Which means an overall decrease in turnout in strong Democratic areas. And then Joe Donnelly actually took a smaller share of the vote in those counties than really successful Democrats have in other years. The other two counties I want to mention are Elkhart County, which is a Republican stronghold, but a place where Democrats can run well. And Joe Donnelly underperformed against those sort of high-performing Democrats. That's bad news for Democrats. The bit of good news for Democrats, though, is Hamilton County, which would normally be considered a very strong Republican area. Joe Donnelly actually outperformed a lot of other strong Democratic candidates from elections gone by, which says maybe the suburbs are a place where Democrats can pick up some votes. Now, obviously, flip all of that, and you have the good and the bad news for Republican candidates.
On the side of the General Assembly, how did some of the major races that you saw from election night turn out, and what does that bode, I guess, as far as the 2019 General Assembly session is concerned?
No doubt one of the biggest surprises is Mike Delf in the Indianapolis area, a very conservative member of the General Assembly, somebody who actually got into a fair amount of disagreements with his own caucus. Over the years, he was defeated by a Democrat. Most people figured that if he was going to lose at some point, it was going to be in a primary. He actually lost in a general election. And I think that's where a lot of people point their fingers. And although the Democrats managed to pick up some seats, they still have ended up in the super minority now that we know the results from Porter County.
Mm-hmm.
That super minority, in many respects, has not mattered a whole lot. Because the Republicans have, in part because they're able to do pretty much whatever they wish, they have not taken huge advantage of it. In other words, they haven't pushed an agenda that is so far to the right that Democrats would say things like, we're going to walk out even though we know that it won't do any good, we're going to walk out anyway. They've not been pushed so far that they've chosen to do that. And, you know, Republicans have occasionally reached across the aisle and said, well, we need to work on this issue or that issue. When you're in the supermajority, you can afford to lose several votes per bill from your side and still win. So they've not pushed things the way they could have. Doesn't mean that they won't in the future, and they technically are still in the supermajority. So although they are in a very, very strong position, they've not taken full advantage of it. I think that's probably what we can expect to see in the upcoming session.
And we know it's not been all that many years ago since there actually was a Democratic walkout in the General Assembly, and some of the lawmakers, particularly from around Northwest Indiana, spent some time over in the Chicago area, I guess cooling their heels, so to speak, waiting for things to settle down in Indianapolis before they finally came back. Is there any possibility that even though we still have the supermajority at the State House, that could happen again?
Well, it would be symbolic. Back when they did it because it mattered. They took off because when they left the Capitol building, nothing could be done. If they were to do that now, it would be symbolic. They wouldn't have to leave the state. They could simply say, we're all going into the caucus room, have fun on your own here, mm-hmm. or we're all going to go across the street to a hotel lobby or out into the park or what they would probably do now is actually, I'm not going to say they probably would, what they could do now, they could just say, we're going out to the steps of the Capitol building and we're going to hold a rally that says what you're trying to do right now is really bad and wrong. Go ahead and do it while we're out there getting a lot of press and getting people excited in the way we want to get them excited.
Now, we know that Organization Day is coming up next week at the State House, where we have not only the existing lawmakers, the veteran lawmakers, the incumbents that have gotten reelected coming back, and we have the new faces, as you say, some of them, mostly Democrats, are going to be coming in for their first opportunity to learn how the legislature works. Do you see any changes or surprises that may come out of Organization Day next week?
Probably not, although an awful lot of people wondered about Brian Bosma because of the let's call it, negative press that came out shortly before the election. Mm-hmm. He did he held on to his seat, not with the sizable margin he normally does, but he still held on to his seat. There are some people who are wondering if that would put him in a weakened position, and in fact, maybe so weak that it would cost him something. We'll have to wait and see. I think that maybe if it did cost him something, it's the sort of thing that you and I aren't going to notice because we're not in the caucus room. We're not in the room where the party gets together and says, okay, this is what our real position is on these issues, Mr. Speaker. We're going this route no matter what it is you say. There may be some of that. We may see some people moving into more visible leadership positions than they have held in the past. That's a definite possibility, but in the end, those will be moments where people like you and I watch it and say, oh, this is what we think that means, but we won't necessarily have proof that that's what happened.
Now, looking in your crystal ball, what kind of issues do you see may come out at the 2019 General Assembly this session?
The budget's going to dominate everything. Of course, the budget's going to be it. Related to the budget, though, I think that we will have some interesting conversations about betting. Not necessarily because people believe that there should be a bunch of new taxation or allowing some betting, but it's a source of revenue, and because of recent changes, it's something that people kind of have to consider. The initial understanding at the state level is that the money that would be generated by this new betting may not be that large, and therefore tread lightly, so to speak, because it's not like it's going to be some massive, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars windfall. But once again, we'll have to wait and see. It could always move in a different direction. Regardless of that, within the budget, people will talk about funding for DCF, no doubt, probably some school safety spending, and then the tuition discussion that always happens. I think that we'll also hear a little bit about hate crime. Whether something actually passes or not remains to be seen, but I think it's safe to say that we will hear something about hate crimes as well. And then I'm going to throw an oldie but a goodie, so to speak, in there, and that would be alcohol. There were sort of two schools of thought when Sunday sales were implemented. One school was, okay, we're never going to discuss alcohol again for, you know, another decade or so. And the other school of thought was, nope, the dam has now been broken. We're going to have a one-year sort of quiet period, and then we're going to come back hard and heavy to try and get what we want in terms of cold sales at convenience stores and those sorts of things. Those are going to come up. Whether they dominate the legislature or not remains to be seen. And then there was an awful lot of talk of changing workforce development last session. Many of those changes were going to require changes in funding, and I think that we will hear an awful lot more about that as well, because it's workforce development is basically economic development. And when your unemployment rate is as low as ours is, if you're still talking about the need for economic development, well, you got to do something. And that means training some folks up and getting them ready to go to work.
Well, that's certainly with the focus on the new jobs of the future being the case with an aging workforce, with the baby boomers and others, they have to do some serious planning on kind of upgrade the education system.
Exactly. And that has to be recognized not only in terms of K-12, what happens in K-12 schools, but post-secondary, and I would argue certificates, et cetera, and just general training that could be done on, you know, a very customized basis for particular employers, and that training may or may not result in any sort of certificate, but still essential to employees for particular industries.
Well, Andy, thank you for spending time with us to talk about the election just ended and look ahead to the 2019 General Assembly session starting in January. Andy Downs is the Executive Director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at Purdue University Fort Wayne, and thank you for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
I grew up in Reedfield, Indiana, with my grandparents. And then I moved to Valpo when I turned 18 because my grandparents, they didn't. I'm going to live with them forever. So when we were 18, we had to move out on our own. My grandparents raised 12 grandkids, and we live in one room, or three rooms. There was a kitchen, a bathroom, and a bedroom for the girls. So there are 12 girls, and my grandparents raised all of us. Because my parents wasn't best parents. They was alcoholics and druggies. We was almost ready to go to the state, and my grandparents stepped in and took us. With one bedroom, room, it was like taking a bowl like a deli and you go to the restroom. Then we had to wash our clothes, and then we had to go hang them up on the line to dry. And if we didn't do that, then we were going to throw the clothes the next day. My grandma said, that's responsibilities. My ton was going backwards, and they couldn't figure out why. I couldn't say certain words. So like my parents, they didn't care. So my grandma took me to the doctor, and it was too late, and they had to go in and clip my tongue and sew it up because it was like choking me while I was trying to say words. Sometimes I like to would try to go to work. I like to help people clean their houses and stuff, but nobody will hire me. They put me on Social Security because I couldn't get a job. And then I got pregnant with my daughter, Monica. And she has a lot of health issues. She has cerebral palsy and fat two or G2. And so she's, a lot of work. I took care of her on my own. She'd be 20 in September. I did it for 20 years by myself. But her dad's not in the picture. And she had back surgery and, health issues. So I had to get up in the morning, like 7 and 8 o'clock in the morning, get her fed and change and her diaper change and bathe and dress. Then I had to take care of my nieces. At the time, my sister was living with me. We lived there for like 7 years, and then we went on separate ways. She wasn't very good. My sister went down the wrong path, and so I just stayed, away and took care of my daughter and my nieces. I was looking up my Social Security check. My rent was $390 and my check was $575. And time I paid my rent and my NIPSCO, that's pretty much where my money went. And we didn't have a vehicle, so we walked a lot everywhere. And we made too much money for food stamps, so I couldn't get food stamps. My sister, she won't apply for food stamps for her and her kids. And every once in a while she'd be nice and take them shopping, buy them groceries and bring them back to the apartment. But we just lived at the food pantry. We go to the food pantries. And sometimes we went to the trustees, get a trustee voucher for the grocery store. Sometimes it made me feel bad because people are still at you. And you just feel down. People talk, don't you think she needs to do something, for having kids? And I tell these people, these are my nieces and my daughter, you just feel low, you just don't have no self-esteem when you go to the food pantries. But now I think, well, you're here too, so I guess you're in the same boat that I am.
You can find more stories online at welcomeproject, one word, .valpo.edu. And Indiana Foster Youth has been recognized with a national award from the Department of Health and Human Services. Joshua Christian will receive the Adoption Excellence Award in Washington, D.C. later this month. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan sat down with him to talk with him about how a caseworker turned parent helped direct his success.
Talk a little bit about, you know, having that person in your life at that point that really was a mentor for you before he became your father, and what that really meant and how that started to turn your life around.
Growing up through care, I've had tons of people invest their time in me through support systems, like through guidance counselors, coaches, at my teams in athletics, and they were all supports that were shifting. But when my dad came into play as my case manager, he was consistent, and he stayed in my life, and I would go to him for any type of advice, and it was really made me feel secure as a person because I knew I had somebody to go to.
You're going to college. You were able to graduate from high school, and you're in college. What are you studying?
I'm studying psychology in college, and I'm going to get a concentration in social work. After college, I would like to be a lobbyist and change policy for kids in the child welfare system.
Talking about policy, you were able to, you know, present a recommendation to the state's commission for improving the status on children. What was that recommendation?
The recommendation was to extend services from age 21 to age 23 in foster care in Indiana.
Do you think that's a great need in Indiana?
Absolutely. There are tons of kids all the time aging out of care without homes. And after the age of 21, they don't really have any support.
And you've worked with an organization called Indiana Connected by 25. What has this organization been able to help you do?
Connected by 25 has really helped me to grow as a person, really discover what being an advocate is for myself.
Is there something that stands out as far as the system goes that's been really difficult for you as a kid growing up in Indiana?
So one of the challenges I faced growing up through the child welfare system was sometimes leaving from one home to another with just a trash bag on my shoulder with some items in it. I know another challenge is just moving into a stranger's house sometimes. When you do that, sometimes it's assumed that you will just fit in and know the rules right away, right? And so you just kind of put on this kind of mask to kind of survive for a little bit.
A lot of children that, you know, go through the system and have the experiences that you've had, you know, for their whole entire life, it's very difficult for them to, you know, build themselves back up. You've been able to do that. Has there been something from your experiences that you feel has really made you stronger?
From my experiences in building myself back up, my faith has played a lot in this. Just really looking to Christ as another consistency in my life.
Moving forward, changing policy, you hope to possibly become a lobbyist. Is that something you're passionate about?
Absolutely. I do want to be a lobbyist. I want to change policies for the kids for the better good.
With this award, congratulations, by the way. What does that mean to you to just be able to be, you know, recognized for the work that you're doing?
I'm very honored and excited to receive this award because in the advocacy world, sometimes you are advocating a lot, and just seeing recognition for it is pretty exciting, pretty awesome, and it'll be a nice time to meet others that are doing the same thing, just like me.
Thank you so much for coming in today, Joshua.
That was Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan talking with Joshua Christian, who will be honored in Washington, D.C. this week during National Adoption Month. Getting close to Thanksgiving here in Northwest Indiana, which means it's an opportunity to help the folks that may not be expecting a very good Thanksgiving Day meal. And that's where the Food Bank of Northwest Indiana comes in handy. And we have Steve Beekman, who's the executive director of the food bank, with us. Steve, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Tell us here, we have two holiday food assistance opportunities coming up, the first of which is going to be actually tomorrow, Wednesday, November 14th. Tell us about the importance of holiday food assistance and more about the two dates that are scheduled here in the next couple weeks.
Yeah, definitely. So we're partnering with a lot of great partners year after year. And again, we're doing again once again this year with the first one starting tomorrow. We have a great relationship with Majestic Star Casino Hotel, as well as Jewel Osco, and we're providing 1,000 meals just in time for Thanksgiving at two different distributions. This has been a annual thing that the food bank has done in partnership with Jewel Osco and Majestic Star Casino to provide such needed meals during the holiday season. So we kick off the holiday season with this distribution. Tomorrow, the first one is at the YWCA in Gary. That starts at 10 a.m., goes to 12, and then we're doing our own distribution on the same day tomorrow from 4 to 6 at the Food Bank of Northwest Indiana at 6490 Broadway in Maryville.
And then the final one's coming up here the following week, next Wednesday, the 21st, and that's happening also here in the Maryville area, is it not?
Yeah, definitely. So we have another one next week. That's sponsored by Strack and Van Til that provides the meals for this distribution. And that's going to be at the Living Hope Church, which is 9000 Taft Street in Maryville. Again, that's next Wednesday, November 21st. And then we conclude our holiday distribution with our Hope for the Holiday food distribution sponsored by NIPSCO in December, where we have two different distributions. The first one beginning on December 8th at Christ Lutheran Church in Valparaiso from 9 to 12. And then we conclude our holiday Hope for the Holiday distribution that's sponsored by NIPSCO on Friday, December 14th. And that's going to be, again, that's sponsored by NIPSCO as well as Legacy Foundation. Mm-hmm. And that will be at our food bank location, 6490 Broadway in Maryville. That will be from 3 to 6 p.m.
What do you typically be able to put out for these holiday food assistance opportunities there? What do folks, if they come by, they are in need of food assistance, what do they usually get when they come by?
Yeah, definitely. It varies depending on the distributions, but we do try to provide a well-rounded meal. I know the distribution tomorrow and next week will provide turkey. It'll include vegetables and some other Thanksgiving items that also are included. And then we try to follow it up with the same type of meals for the December distribution as well. So a lot of it depends on what's available, what we can purchase, what are being donated. But we're very thankful for the Jewel Osco and the Strack and Van Til stores to provide a lot of these meals.
I was going to say that it's very important that you have these partners like Jewel Osco and like Strack and Van Til's that help out, because I'm sure that they probably can contribute a good portion of what the Food Bank of Northwest Indiana can make available to families that come by.
Yeah, without a doubt. These meals were not be able to provide without their contribution of food donations to us for their distributions, and also with sponsorships like NIPSCO, as well as some funding from local foundations like Legacy Foundation, that we're able to provide so many meals during the holiday season. And I think during the holiday season is a very difficult time for a lot of families that are struggling to make ends meet. And if you put on top of that with all the Thanksgiving and Christmas celebrations, it creates more challenges and more difficulties to provide healthy, nutritious meals. So this is one part of how we can help people during those times.
We're talking with Steve Beekman, who is the Executive Director of the Food Bank of Northwest Indiana, about the holiday food distribution opportunities coming up here. And I know there's also one that comes up near the end of the month to go along with another opportunity that's around the region that we talk about occasionally. In this case, we're talking about Charitable Tuesday, but you guys have kind of changed it around a little bit, at least changed the name anyway, calling it Giving Tuesday, Giving Foods Tuesday. Tell me what you're going to call it on November 27th.
So we're trying to change things up a little bit. I think that there's different ways that people can contribute. Obviously, they can always go to our website, Food Bank NWI, to make a donation, financial gift. But not everyone can. So we're trying to create ways for people to also give back, if it's not financially, but also by how they can come volunteer. And so for Giving Tuesday, we're really encouraging people, individuals and families to come give back in a different way by volunteering and packing some of these holiday meal boxes that we're preparing to provide during the holiday season. So we're encouraging people to go to our website to sign up to volunteer as well. And then I think if people can also go to our website to donate, but also during the holiday season, November, December, Strack and Van Til does an amazing fundraising campaign for the food bank by doing the checkout challenge, where they round up, you have the ability to round up your total and all those dollars that are raised through that checkout challenge campaign goes directly to the Food Bank of Northwest Indiana. That really enables us to purchase more food to local families that need food assistance.
Yeah, I've already done that here at the close Strachan Van Tilta where I live. I already rounded up here on the last time I stopped by at the checkout, too. And also, too, you've got some great assistance from PayPal. Tell us what they're going to be involved in here with this November 27th event.
I'm unfamiliar with the PayPal process. We have a lot going on with a lot of our volunteer groups, but also through our donors and supporters. So we have a lot of different ways people are able to give back in different ways, if it's doing food drives or it's raising dollars to help support our efforts. We have a lot of different partnerships, and if anybody's interested in helping out during the holiday season, I encourage them to reach out to us through our website or call us up and talk about how they would like to give back during the holiday season. Mm-hmm. If it's volunteering for themselves or it's from their corporate group that wants to come volunteer and help with the distribution or create their own fundraising opportunities. We're always interested in creating more of those relationships and partnerships.
That's great. That's great. Later in the month, actually, or I should say in December, about the time that the Christmas break happens for our students coming out of school, they're going to be staying at home pretty much here with the holidays coming up here. But we know that, unfortunately, a lot of young people rely on their free meals at school and their breakfast at school to help get them through the day when they're in classes. And when there's no school, it means for a lot of people, unfortunately, no meals, I understand. What's the Food Bank of Northwest Indiana helping to do on that?
During the school year, we provide backpacks for kids that to help supplement their meals over the weekend. And so we provide about 300 to 400 backpacks each Friday during the school year. And when the school is on break, we double up on those backpacks to help assist with their meals for the breaks. But we also provide, through our mobile marketplace, weekly mobile food distributions throughout the Lake and Porter County every week. And so we will continue that program, and we try to target more school-based locations to help offset some of those challenges, like you were saying, when school's out and they don't have the free reduced meal program going on. We need to be able to provide more food to those families that are struggling. So we do a lot of mobile market food distributions where we provide about 100 to 300 meals per distributions per family.
Now, finally, Steve, bring us up to date, if you will, on a capital campaign. It's an opportunity to help the Food Bank of Northwest Indiana to be able to grow, to meet its mission in supporting people who most need the help all year long, for that matter, too. But it's an opportunity to help expand the operation that you just all moved into not long ago there on Broadway in Merrillville. How is the capital campaign coming along and trying to reach your goal?
The Fighting Hunger, Building Hope campaign continues. We're continuing to bring different tours and visitors to come by to see the new location and see what the additional second phase of the construction build-out is going to be. It's really focused on creating long-term solutions to people that are experiencing poverty and food insecurity. And we're really getting people excited about this second phase to conclude our capital campaign. It's a $4 million goal. We're reached about $2.7 million to our goal, so we're looking to close this $1.3 million gap in the next year in order to finish the construction build-out of our new location. But like you said, we have moved into the new location, and it was very good timing because now we're able to accept all different types of donated products. Otherwise, we would have had to turn away at our old location. So we do see an increase of a lot of food being donated through retails, but also just large loads that are going through the region that we're able to accept, which is exciting. So that also enables us to provide more meals to Lake and Porter County, which we are. So we're creating a big impact already, but we really want to make a bigger impact with this phase two of the capital campaign. We would like to close this out the next year.
Well, best of luck on that, Steve, as we go out of 2018 and head toward 2019 and continuing on the capital campaign as well. And all the great programs that are available through the Food Bank of Northwest Indiana to help families that need the help this time of year to meet those holiday meals for sure. And for the young people who need some extra help when they're not in school, they're not getting the assistance at school and their meals, they'll have that assistance with these backpacks as well, too. And we appreciate you telling us all about this and bringing us up to date, too, on the capital campaign, and we hope to have you back again soon to give us more updates.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Steve Beekman is the executive director of the Food Bank of Northwest Indiana. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. The first Tuesday after Thanksgiving is known as Charitable Tuesday. It's a day that's really dedicated to giving back rather than consuming, even though it's so close to Thanksgiving Day. But to find out more about how we can take advantage properly of Giving Tuesday, let's talk to Northwest Indiana Financial Advisor Greg Hammer. Thank you for joining us as always today.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, tell us a little bit more about Giving Tuesday and why it's important, or Charitable Tuesday, I guess it's known as that too, why it's so important and some of the things we need to know so that we make the right decisions, we don't lose so much money on our taxes, and get to take advantage of how we're using the funds.
Well, I think first and foremost, understanding the new tax laws and some of the changes are making things a little bit more challenging to qualify your charitable distributions or contributions or donations because of the way the tax structure is. So in the past, a lot of folks could get into itemized deduction. It's just going to prove a little bit more difficult now with the standard deduction as high as it is. So while we all still want to give, you know, instead of just saying, hey, you know, we don't get the deduction as much, there are unique things that you can do based on your certain situation.
Wait, you talk about knowing the tax laws better, and they're very confusing to say the least, and got even more so here with the new tax laws that took effect. What are some of the things that we really do need to understand?
So when it comes to just the charitable or itemized deductions, because charitable generally, you know, constitutes a big part of that, fewer taxpayers are going to be able to benefit from itemizing under the new tax laws. And that's just simply because, Chris, the way they're changing the standard deduction, you know, where you used to be, you know, at a $15,000-plus standard deduction, they now have bumped that up, especially if you're over age 65, to $26,500. So for those folks that are in retirement, it's going to prove a lot more difficult to get into an itemized situation. And so when you look at a contribution that you make to a charitable organization, to a church, to a particular cause, the only way that that's going to benefit you on your tax return is if in fact your itemized deductions pass the standard. Otherwise, they're giving it to you already.
I understand that there's something that's out there that maybe people may be aware of by another name, but QCD is the abbreviation for it. What are QCDs, and how are they especially helpful at this time of year with the changes in the tax laws?
So specifically, it's an opportunity for folks that are in the required minimum distribution phase of their life, which is those that are, you know, have attained the age of 70 and a half and they have qualified money. So prior laws would allow, you know, to get to an itemized, again, it wouldn't take much. You could count state tax, property taxes, charitable gifts, interest. Now they've capped a lot of those. Specifically, you know, capping state and local taxes, you know, minimizing the amount of interest that you can use, having to be the first. So when you have a charitable contribution for a lot of families, unless they do considerable charitable contributions, typically they're not going to push them over that threshold of that $26,500 that is now the standard deduction for somebody in that age group. So if you have a required minimum distribution, the law allows you to make that distribution directly to a charitable organization. Doesn't have to be for the whole amount. As long as you are in qualified required minimum distribution stage of your life, you can do $1 or up to $100,000 directly from your IRA to a charitable organization or cause that you have, and it will also satisfy your required minimum distributions.
Yep. And it's quite, there's certain qualifications, like you say, that you have to face. And if you want to take advantage of that, you have to, I guess, be able to put it to your IRA. It's very important that you keep it to that.
Yeah, so the simple way to look at it is, let's say at a $4,000 required minimum distribution, I might give, let's say, to my church over the course of a year $4,000. And when I give that to my tax person, the $4,000 doesn't help me exceed the $26,500. But if I take a check directly from my IRA, get it made out to my church, that $4,000 is then noted on its return as a qualified QCD, a qualified charitable distribution, mm-hmm. and it doesn't ever become part of your income. So in essence, you get the deduction at that point.
That's interesting. It's and all because the laws have changed, I guess. Or could you do something like this in the past, but it's just more important to follow things through because of the new laws?
You hit it right on the head. It's something that's been around for a while. I think about, well, it doesn't matter the years. It was prior to the new tax law.
Right.
But essentially wasn't as relevant because a lot of folks would hit the itemized deductions, and in which case their charitable contributions would count the same way.
We're talking with Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer about matters involving your money and your investments and the like. And conversations like this always come up through the year. But you'd say it's very important to take advantage of the opportunity when you get friends and family members, especially together for the holidays, to be able to sit down and talk about some of these issues. Tell us why this is a good time. You wouldn't think so, but why this would be a good time to talk about this.
Well, I think the first obvious one is most of the holidays when you get together, the majority of the family is going to be there, if not everybody. So if you're going to discuss something that's important, you know, that you feel is critical to your overall planning process or concerns that you have about some of the things that you're doing or parents are doing or siblings are doing or children are doing, I mean, it's you obviously have all the parties involved in one location. And hopefully, you know, you can address it and communicate and be transparent about the discussions.
Is it especially important, too, because like you say, you'll have everybody together. It may not be a real pleasant topic to bring up, but you might have to bring these things up, like estate planning, you know. Nobody wants to think about what's going to happen after you pass away, but, you know, it's something you got to think about.
Well, and you hit it right in the head, because here's the challenge. If you don't talk about it, what typically is going to happen is, you know, you're going to end up losing parts of the estate that really you don't need to, and more importantly, there's a lot of, you know, specific family items or heirlooms or things that maybe certain members of the family want, others don't, and, you know, as a parent, you might have a certain desire for one child to have something that another doesn't, and to clarify all that at the level of the giver, as opposed to after the fact, will often save a lot of stress with siblings or family members, you know, because it becomes more about the money when it really shouldn't have to be.
I suppose, too, here again, it's talking about an unpleasant topic, but it's about tax returns and how to properly plan for all the information that you have to file, especially with the changes and everything.
Absolutely. And it even goes beyond that, Chris, into, like, documents. We have something we call the Family Estate Organizer that we put together for our clients. You know, I always tell my clients it's important information. The kids need to know it, but you don't want them to know until they have to know, type of thing. You know, so being able to take an inventory and organize all of the important things that are going to be necessary, and it goes down to simple things. Where do they locate the titles? You know, is there a safety deposit box? You know, where are all the accounts? I mean, if you've talked to anybody that's ever had to settle an estate, the mystery part of it always is, have I thought of everything? Did I get to everything that mom and dad had? And it becomes stressful, very stressful.
Yeah. And speaking of stressful things, if you don't have the conversations, people aren't aware of such things as retirement. And not only planning for retirement, or we talk about this all the time, of course, but thinking about how to set up your retirement plan, or retirement income plan, but also if you have to deal with all the changes you make when you start drawing Social Security, I imagine.
Absolutely. And retirement planning now has got some very unique, I should say income planning, has some very unique opportunities with the new tax laws, where you determine the source of your income based on the various accounts or sources that you have directly determines what part of your Social Security is going to be reportable or be taxable. So you can be very proactive in how you're planning. When you're working, you don't have that luxury, right? You're not going to tell your employer, pay me less so I pay less taxes. That's crazy. But in retirement, you have the opportunity to direct sources of revenue, and understanding the impact of those sources could directly result in paying a lot more taxes that you don't need to.
Are we finding that a lot of these conversations have to come about here because there are things that are going to actually take effect with the next income tax return that you have to file?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, right now, if you haven't had the opportunity to look at the impact of the new tax laws, you have a window here through the end of the year that you really need to take advantage of and talk to somebody that's proactive in planning as opposed to just preparation. You know, most of us, when we go get our taxes done, it's like, here's what happened last year, tell me what I owe, balance the books.
Mm-hmm.
taking a proactive look at things is going to allow you to change the input and hopefully create strategies to reduce the tax implications. And so that's why it's so important to look at, especially with the opportunity, I feel, with this new tax law that's in place, there's more of an opportunity than we'll probably ever see again in our lifetimes, just because of, you know, where debt is and the budget, and eventually taxes will have to go back up.
Well, maybe not right after the turkey dinner is finished. You know, that's not the time to talk with people about important things. They're usually going to fall asleep, but there is a time now, I guess, during the holidays that you do have to get together and talk about these issues and make sure that you go into 2019 with certainly your eyes open, but better prepared to be sure. We're talking with Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer. And as always, Greg, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Hoosier lawmakers realize the importance and urgency of helping school districts deal with the rising rate in teenage suicides. Indiana Youth Institute President and CEO Tammy Silverman talked about it recently on Regionally Speaking.
The General Assembly, has taken some action to make sure that particularly our educators have more youth suicide prevention training. I think they deeply understood the fact that this is a big issue in Indiana, and they wanted to do something that kind of stepped up our responsiveness to make sure that some of our folks that have the most contact with our kids, so obviously that's educators in many cases, have the training they need, not to intervene and not to be those mental health providers or behavioral health providers that some of these kids really do need, but to be said, all teachers and educators, so that's all principals, all counselors, all the folks that may be teachers' aides, are required to get 2 hours of training specific to youth suicide prevention, and that's every 3 years. But given the fact that the legislation just went into effect, they all have to get their first training this academic year. And there's been a little bit of confusion, that there's some confusion around the wording, but we've talked to the Department of Education and they verified that yes, everyone needs to get that first 2 hours of training this academic year. And as you know, time goes quickly in the school year. And so that's something that they're looking for at all schools. And again, that's for any grades 5 through 12, so middle school and high school as well. And so there are a few trainings that the Department of Ed has identified, the trainings that they consider evidence-based and that are approved. It doesn't mean those are the only ones, but they've started with 3 listed on their website so that schools can go there and start getting that training.
Now, we mentioned here that a lot of this is going to be involving educators and teachers in the public school system, and I'm sure that private schools are probably encouraged around Indiana to join in this as well. Do we find, though, that there may be some issues that people in the Department of Child Services come across when they're working with families that have problems and they're trying to deal with issues there, that maybe that they, if they're not already trained in their own particular ways, that they can help be prepared so that they can kind of head off some of these incidents of suicide?
Well, certainly, and anyone can get this training. And again, for all of us, it's important to have some awareness and sensitivity to this issue. Anyone that comes in contact with kids, because we know that particularly in those adolescent years, in those early adolescent years, sometimes kids open up to different adults, right? So they may not say something to their mom and dad that they might say to their coach or their teacher or their youth group leader. So again, if you go, you know, the Department of Education has links to what some of those trainings are, you know, as well as some great resources. The American Foundation for Suicide Prevention is one of those. The Jason Foundation is another that have, again, some of those technical training aspects, but they also have some great information that parents, grandparents, or caring adults could also benefit from.
We're talking with Tammy Silverman, who is the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute, about some new required training, legislative mandated training that has been reviewed over the last couple of years, but took effect back on June 30th for teachers and educators in grades 5 through 12 in Indiana to participate in the training hours of youth suicide awareness and prevention training. And in working with the State Department of Education, what did folks, your staff there at IYI, do to help speed things along? I'm sure that the Department of Education was going by the guidance that the state legislature had passed on to them, but I'm sure they probably had questions that they felt the IYI might be able to assist them.
certainly. One of the things that we really talked to them about and that they were happy to discuss was the idea that, and we know that the numbers, you know, we're such a data-driven group, the numbers, when you disaggregate the information, there are some kids that are at higher risk of suicide. So that we know that kids that are systems engaged, so that's either foster care or the juvenile justice system, are more likely to contemplate or attempt suicide. We know that kids that identify as LGBTQ are at a significantly higher rate of suicide, as the same holds true for Latino or Hispanic youth. In general, girls are more likely to attempt suicide, are young girls, and are, however, our young men are more likely, unfortunately, to die as a result of suicide because they choose different approaches and different methods. So girls are more likely to cut or take overdoses, and young men are more likely to use a handgun or a firearm or hanging. And so, again, really understanding how this manifests in different groups of kids was what we kind of added to the conversation and wanted to make sure was embedded in this policy. And we've done a couple of trainings on it. We have some more coming up at our big conference in November. And the response to that, our educators know that, right? They work with kids every day. They know the kids that are at highest risk. And they've not only they attended the training filled up immediately to capacity, they've asked for more. So, you know, it's a great thing that our state is really diving headfirst into this and saying we need to talk about it more. We need to make sure training's available for everyone so that hopefully we can prevent this. Suicide is something that's wholly preventable.
Now, Tammy, you've talked in particular here about some of the groups that seem to be more prone to have these problems. Will we break it out even further? Are we finding that there's even maybe the same statistics are the same for urban as well as rural school districts? We have a lot of problems with the inner city young people, but do we have the same kind of problems for young people that are in small communities and in turn are involved in smaller school districts around the state?
Well, both have their challenges, right? So thank you. That's great that you brought that up. And one of the things that I wanted to highlight is that there are actually suicide prevention coalitions around our state. And so there's one in Northwest Indiana. It's called the Northwest Indiana Suicide Prevention Council as well, you know, and that they know what those specific, and they're really trained to deal with the issues in their area. And all of the names and contact information for all of those folks are available on the Department of Ed site, and we also have a link to it on IYI site. So you're right, there are sometimes different issues, but both groups, it's really a matter of feeling connected, right? And in rural areas, the challenge can be that they're far away from peers or support networks. Simultaneously, when you're in perhaps a huge school setting, those kids can feel like they don't have a niche, right, that they don't belong to a group. So it's all about that feeling connected, making sure that these young people know that there are adults, there are plenty of adults that care for them and making that connection and reaching out to them.
That's IOII President and CEO Tammy Silverman. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back with you tomorrow.